Welcome once again to the history of the Catholic Church in the United States, this time to the Age of Jackson. The Age of Jackson does not simply mean the 8 years of Andrew Jackson's presidency. Rather, because Andrew Jackson was such an all-pervasive figure, and his influence went well beyond the years of his own presidency, by common agreement of historians, the Age of Jackson would take in the period 1828 to 1848. So it's within these two decades now that we want to look at the history of Catholicism in the United States. To begin this consideration, I would like you to make a mental image in your mind of the fanciest room in your home. It might be your living room. It might be a room to which you invite only special guests. It would be the room that you would use the least, the one in which you would have your most beautiful furnishings. Now picture, if you will, a stampede of people going into that room, many of them in the state of amiable incandescence, all lit up, tearing the draperies and stampeding over the furniture and spilling things all over the place. The most chaotic scene you can conjure up in your mind, taking place in the fanciest room in your home. Now, the reason we ask you to think of that mental picture is because that is very closely resembling what happened in the White House on the day of Andrew Jackson's inauguration. The greatest rooms of the White House were open, and a stampede of people came in. And believe you me, the White House had quite a bill cleaning this thing up the day after inauguration. But this was the era of the common man, and many of these people, backwoodsmen, illiterate people, were so thrilled with the fact that someone of a somewhat similar background and sympathy to themselves, like Andrew Jackson, was elected president. Many of the aristocratic commentators of that era looked on the scene and said, if this was ushering in the era of the common man, what is the United States of America in store for? Well, we certainly were coming into a period in our national life when aristocracy was not in vogue, but rather the common man was. Now, into these 20 years of American history, we look at the history of U.S. Catholicism. And we have to begin by saying this was a period, as far as the Catholic Church was concerned, of great immigration. Immigration to the East Coast of the United States, and particularly immigration from Ireland and from Germany, as far as Roman Catholics were concerned. If you were an immigrant from Ireland, you probably were coming to the United States for economic reasons. If you were an immigrant from Germany, you probably were coming to the United States for political reasons. But nonetheless, Catholic immigrants from both of these countries of Western Europe came, and they would be coming in profusion through the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and for that matter, the 50s and 60s in the 19th century. That very famous Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote the book Democracy in America, and who was such a shrewd commentator on American life and mores himself, commented on Roman Catholics as he found them in these decades in the United States. And this is what Alexis de Tocqueville wrote. Quotes, "They were faithful to the observance of their religion. They were zealous in the belief of their doctrines. They were, at one and the same time, the most submissive believers and yet the most independent citizens." Isn't that a wonderful comment? The most submissive believers. They were devoutly Catholic and yet the most independent citizens. They were as fiercely loyal to the United States as anyone else. Certainly, New York City on the East Coast received the greatest percentage of these immigrants from Europe, and some of them were quite famous people in their day, regardless of what country they came from. John Delmonico, for example, was the famous restaurateur, and he was a leading parishioner at Transfiguration Church on the Lower East Side in what would today be Chinatown. You can still go and visit the beautiful parish of Transfiguration. It's just a few blocks down the street from St. Patrick's Old Cathedral at the corner of Mott and Pearl Street. Another man who came to New York in these years was a Haitian slave, a black man by the name of Pierre Toussaint. Pierre Toussaint lived to be 95 years of age, and he made his living in New York City as a hairstylist, a hairdresser, if you will. All the fashionable women of New York would come to Pierre Toussaint to have their hair styled and fashioned and the like. But that's not what we remember him for. We remember him for his holiness of life. In fact, Pierre Toussaint was such a holy man that his cause for sainthood has been introduced. One of his biographers describes Pierre Toussaint this way. "It is the whole which strikes me when thinking about him, not simply his words, not simply his deeds, but rather his entire faith, love, and charity." Pierre Toussaint was a daily communicant every morning of his life at St. Peter's Church on Barclay Street in Lower Manhattan. An entirely different kind of immigrant who came to New York in those days would be a man by the name of James Gordon Bennett. James Gordon Bennett became the editor of the New York Herald, or the New York Tribune, as it was called in his time. He was a Scottish Catholic immigrant, and he certainly was a continuing thorn in the side to Episcopal authority in the city of New York, and for that matter, in the Diocese of New York. James Gordon Bennett's very pungent comments in the pages of the New York Tribune were usually of a very, very negative nature and directed against Episcopal authority and directed in the way he thought the church should be run. What a difference between him on the one side, Pierre Toussaint on the other. Philadelphia was no less colorful as far as the immigrants it had. We talked in an earlier episode about Matt Carey and Robert Walsh, Matt Carey giving the democratic philosophy of government, Robert Walsh giving the federalist philosophy of government and entertaining their readers. Carey, by the way, you can visit his grave in the graveyard of Old St. Mary's in Philadelphia. Robert Walsh later went to France, and he's buried very close to the Palace of Versailles in France. Francis Drexel was a famous Austrian immigrant who came to the city of Philadelphia, and of the large family that Francis Drexel had, only one of his sons remained a Roman Catholic. But it was very good for us that that son did remain a Roman Catholic, because the son inherited much of the tremendous fortune of his father, and the son directed that that tremendous fortune of Francis Drexel be given to the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament for the care of Indians and colored people, as their official title was. Why were those particular sisters given all this fortune? Because this man's daughter just happened to be Mother and now Blessed Catherine Drexel, the founder of those wonderful sisters. In these early decades, my friends, you do not find strong lay leadership in the church. You find very influential lay Catholics, but they were influential for other reasons. You don't find strong lay leadership. Why not? Well, because Catholic higher education was just in its rudimentary stages, just coming into its own. That's one reason. Another reason is that the Catholics were an immigrant population, and they were entirely preoccupied with making a living. Another consideration is that the strong theology of the laity that has been given us by the Second Vatican Council in our time had not yet come into vogue. It was a long way from it. All of these factors in combination probably account for the fact that you do not have strong lay leadership. Nonetheless, you have a strong buildup of the church in the 1820s, the 30s, and the 40s. The Archdiocese of Baltimore, that premier see, the first diocese established in the country, seemed to remain the first in importance. John Carroll, of course, passed from the scene in 1815. He was succeeded by his coadjutor bishop, Leonard Neal. And there follow a series of rather distinguished men. The English-born James Whitfield came next. Then another Marylander, a Sulpician by the name of Samuel Eccleston. He was followed by Francis Patrick Kenrick, who was one of the great writers in moral theology at mid-century. Kenrick himself was followed by Martin John Spaulding of an old Maryland, Kentucky family. Spaulding was followed by James Roosevelt Bailey, who was a former Episcopalian minister, a convert to Roman Catholicism, the nephew of Mother Elizabeth Seton, and a cousin of both Presidents Roosevelt. Now, Baltimore was the premier see because it was the first. It was looked to. The Archbishop of Baltimore's opinions were always sought out. But there were other very prominent men emerging in these mid-19th century years. One of them had to have been Archbishop John Hughes in New York, who more affectionately is referred to as Dagger John. If you were a politician speaking out against the church, Dagger John spoke out against you. If you were an Irish revolutionary who favored a violent means to a solution to the problems in Ireland, Dagger John spoke out against you. If you were an anti-Catholic bigot in the city of New York in those days, watch out for Dagger John. Bishop John Hughes actually formed his own political party, which he called the Carroll Hall Party. He ran a slate of candidates in 1842 with only one objective, and that was to try to secure state aid for the running of parochial schools in New York. The ticket was only formed 4 or 5 days before the state elections in 1842 and made a tremendously large showing. Didn't win, but it just goes to show you the power of Archbishop Hughes in New York. In Philadelphia, we had the saintly John N. Newman, or John N. Neumann, who was canonized by Pope Paul VI in 1977 and who gave to the church in our country that magnificent devotion of the 40 hours, a devotion in which we pledge our faith in the real, true presence of our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. What a saint for these times John Neumann is, when we need a renewal in our belief in the presence of our divine Lord in the Blessed Sacrament. The church was building, it was expanding. Places like Chicago, Cincinnati, Milwaukee in the Midwest were becoming enormous centers of Catholic growth and prestige and influence. People like John Baptist Purcell, the Archbishop of Cincinnati, was growing in stature. Or Peter Richard Kenrick, who would head the Archdiocese of St. Louis for well over 50 years. Catholic mission foreign aid societies were pouring money into the church. We had organizations like the Ludwig Missionary Aid Society, established by King Ludwig in Bavaria. You had the Leopoldine Foundation, established by the Emperor Franz I of Austria. Things seemed to be going very, very well. John L. O'Sullivan was a famous writer. He wrote an article in the Democratic Review, and he said it was the manifest destiny of the United States to spread its views, to spread this great democratic experiment throughout the world. It seemed as though it was a wonderfully optimistic time. It seemed as though the church was growing and developing. But something was going to go seriously wrong in the 1840s. And what went seriously wrong was the fact that this was the period of time in which anti-Catholicism began to raise its head. This was the time in which we must begin talking about the problem of nativism, the problem of anti-Catholic prejudice in a strong, organized way. How was anti-Catholic prejudice manifested in the United States? Well, it was manifested in the minds of very prominent American writers and thinkers. For example, you could take Lyman Beecher. Lyman Beecher, the father of Harriet Beecher Stowe of Uncle Tom's Cabin fame. Lyman Beecher was a professor at Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati. And listen to what Lyman Beecher thought about the Catholic Church. We quote him. "The Catholic Church holds now in darkness and bondage nearly half the civilized world. It is the most skillful, dreadful, powerful system of corruption to those who wield it, and slavery and debasement to those who live under it." He didn't like Catholics very much. Nor did Samuel F. B. Morse, the developer of the telegraph. Do you remember that famous telegraph message when the cable was laid from Baltimore to Washington? "What hath God wrought?" Well, what God wrought in Samuel F. B. Morse was a great deal of anti-Catholicism. Samuel F. B. Morse wrote a book in the 1840s entitled A Foreign Conspiracy Against the Liberties of the United States. He feared Catholic schools. He feared Catholic priests. He feared Catholic politicians. He feared Catholic immigrants. He feared Catholic people in general. He said they're trying to take our rights and liberties away from us. The Catholics get too powerful in this country. What's going to happen? A tunnel is going to be dug between the Vatican and Washington. And once that tunnel is dug, the Pope is going to come right over and take over the United States of America if these Catholics get too far. One famous American who was strongly influenced by the writings of Samuel F. B. Morse was a young boy growing up in Hannibal, Missouri, Samuel Clemens Mark Twain. Listen to what Mark Twain said. "I have been educated to enmity toward everything that is Catholic. And sometimes, in consequence of this, I find it much easier to discover Catholic faults than Catholic merits." You also had lots of anti-Catholic literature. You had Rebecca Reeves' 6 months in a Convent. You had the awful disclosures of Maria Monk. Maria Monk was supposedly someone who had lived in the Hotel Dieu nunnery in Montreal, and she describes in lurid detail the relationships between priests and nuns going on in convents, and the illegitimate children born of these unions, and the children killed immediately. The American reading public actually bought this stuff, and they believed it. They believed these kind of horror stories went on in convents. So you had anti-Catholic speakers, you had anti-Catholic writers, and you had anti-Catholic mob violence. Certainly one of the best examples of mob violence took place in the 1840s up in Charlestown, Massachusetts, at an institution called Mount Benedict. Mount Benedict was a boarding school for girls that was run by the Ursuline Sisters. And there were a number of anti-Catholic people in town who had these contrived suspicions that all kinds of horrors were going on inside the boarding house. So on one particular evening, a large mob went up and they knocked on the door, and the Mother Superior came to the door and they said, "We demand you to let us in here to see what's going on in this boarding house." Listen, the Mother Superior said, the Bishop of Boston has 20,000 Irishmen at his disposal in a moment, and if you cause any problem here, they will attack you. Well, that subdued the mob, but not for long. They insisted on going in and seeing what was going on. They did go in. They found that absolutely nothing was going on. So what do you think they decided to do? They burned down the Ursuline convent. Burned it right to the ground. There was a travesty of a trial that followed this terrible episode. The Bishop of Boston was called to testify. The superior of the convent was called to testify. But interestingly, the jurors who were selected to hear the case were never asked what their opinion was on Catholicism before they sat on the jury. There were a few minor raps on the knuckles to a few of the instigators, nothing serious, and absolutely no compensation was paid to the Ursuline sisters for the loss of this magnificent institution for girls. You had riots in the Kensington section of Philadelphia in 1844. Many people believe that there was a lot of ammunition that was being stored in the basement of Catholic churches in the Kensington section, and they decided that they were going to get in and get the ammunition. What kind of ammunition? Well, ammunition that the ancient order of Hibernians were going to use to go around Philadelphia blowing up Protestant churches and all this kind of thing. This was believed. In 1844, a man by the name of James Harper was elected mayor of the city of New York. He was elected on the Native American ticket. And the Archbishop of New York, John Hughes, heard that there was a great rally that was being planned for Central Park in New York City to celebrate the election of Harper as mayor of the city. And he went public, the Archbishop did. He said, if this rally goes on and if it becomes violent, the city will become a second Moscow. And by that he meant he was not going to tolerate any violence in New York City. And to this day, at St. Patrick's Old Cathedral on the corner of Mott and Pearl Street, you can see a plaque commemorating the ancient order of Hibernians and the great contribution they made when, at the call of Archbishop John Hughes, they rallied to the defense of St. Patrick's Cathedral when it was threatened by the forces of violence and intemperance. So we had writers and we had speakers and we had mob violence, but all of these things, my friends, were manifestations of nativism. Nativism was, first and foremost, a political movement. You had in the 1840s the Native American Party. You had in the 1850s the Know-Nothing Party. They were both similar in their objectives. They called for a 21-year residency requirement for voting. They said no Roman Catholics should be allowed to vote, and they said no Roman Catholics should be allowed to hold political office. They were active on the state, on the local and the state and the national level. At least the Native Americans were active on the local and the state level. The Know-Nothings were active on the local, the state, and the national level. The Know-Nothings actually became powerful enough to elect, or rather to nominate, a candidate for President of the United States in the presidential election of 1856. The candidate was Millard Fillmore. He had been a former President of the United States. Where do you think Fillmore was when he found out that he had received the nomination of the Know-Nothing Party for President of the United States? He was in the Vatican. He had just come out of an audience with Pope Pius IX moments before. And curiously, Fillmore carried only one state in the Union. The state was Maryland, where you have the greatest concentration of Catholics in colonial days. Talk about the ironies of history. So nativism, then, was a political movement that had all of these other manifestations which we have been talking about. It was a very sorry chapter in our national life, but it is one that we always have to consider because we have to realize the tremendous adversities that Catholics faced coming into this country. You had people like William Craig Brownlee writing in the New York Observer, writing very, very pungent anti-Catholic editorials. This man was affecting not only New Yorkers, he was affecting the entire country with his anti-Catholic editorials. And there were all kinds of publications like the New York Observer, the American Protestant Vindicator, edited by William Craig Brownlee, was yet another example of what we're talking about. These people, you see, were motivated by fear of the unknown. They didn't know the Catholic Church. They knew nothing about Catholics. And so they responded this way. Professor Sidney Ahlstrom at Yale, the great writer of the religious history of the American people, said, you have to look at people in groups. There's security in groups. Protestant America had been here in much larger numbers for a greater period of time. They were the powerful group. And then they see this other tremendously powerful group of Catholic immigrants coming into the United States, and they say, my heavens, we're going to be deprived of our rights. and our liberties. So fear is always what motivates prejudice. These were good people, but they were fearful people, and they went on the attack against Catholics. There are a few interesting sidelines to this story, by the way. William Henry Seward, the former governor of New York, really wanted the Republican nomination for president in 1860. He was going into the convention, to the wigwam in Chicago. He was the leading contender for the nomination. But years earlier, when Seward was governor of New York, back in 1842, remember we mentioned about Bishop Hughes having his Carroll Hall party and running a slate of candidates who would support the cause of aid for parochial schools? Well, Seward was the governor of New York at the time, and Seward strongly favored what Archbishop Hughes was trying to do. That was 1842. Now, 18 years later, that was going to come back to haunt William Henry Seward. The delegates to the Republican National Convention came to the wigwam in Chicago, and they were battling back and forth among themselves, as often happened at political conventions in those days, as to who would get the nomination. And, as we say, Governor Seward went to the convention as the leading contender. Wait a minute, some of the delegates said. We better take a second look at Seward. Look at the cause that he favored back in 1842. Now, if we're going to get this nomination, if we're going to wrestle the White House away from the Democrats who were so divided, and the Republicans knew they had a good chance to wrestle the White House away in 1860, but if they were going to do it, they needed a man who had not alienated a substantial block of voters. Now, Seward had alienated a substantial block of voters by favoring Catholic claims. So, the political bosses at the convention said, we need know-nothing support to win this nomination and to win the election. Now, if we're going to get know-nothing support, we need a man who has not alienated the know-nothings, a man who has not taken any position on immigrants, a man who has not been pro-Catholic, favorable to Catholics, either by what he has said publicly or what he has done in office. Seward's already blown his chances. So therefore, we have to get someone who's been non-committal on the whole immigrant question, who's never said anything about Catholics one way or another. So what did they do with the Republican National Convention in 1860? They turned to a little-known rail splitter from Illinois by the name of Abraham Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln, who incidentally had some Catholic first cousins himself in Illinois, which is another interesting story if we had time to go into it. Mr. Lincoln became the Republican nominee in 1860. And one other highlight to the story of nativism, know-nothingism, Pope Pius IX sent a personal representative to this country in the 1850s in the person of Archbishop Gaetano Bedini. Now, Archbishop Bedini was actually stopping in the United States. This was not his final goal. Archbishop Bedini was traveling for the Holy Father to different parts of the world to check especially on political situations. In point of fact, he was on his way to Latin America. But Archbishop Bedini came to Washington, and he had a visit with the then President of the United States, who was Franklin Pierce. And Bedini brought with him to Washington a very, very beautiful, very large slab of Carrara marble from Italy. It was the gift of the Holy Father, Pope Pius IX, and very specifically, it was to be inserted in the Washington Monument, which was just then going up. Now, some nativists, or rather some know-nothings, got wind of the fact that the Archbishop had brought with him this very nice gift from the Holy Father. So evening came, and what did the know-nothings do? They took off with the slab of marble. Some accounts say that they actually took it and dropped it in the Potomac River. That is not 100% substantiated. But it absolutely was stolen, and the Holy Father's gift never did get into the Washington Monument. So all of these things now in combination represent the Native American movement of the 1840s, the Know-Nothing movement of the 1850s. It was a hard time for Catholics in this country, but it was something that was going to pass from the scene. Catholics were very, very quickly going to have a chance to become stronger again, to assert their patriotism once again. How will they do it? They would do it by the service they rendered in the war between the states, the Civil War, and it is to that conflict that we will turn in our next episode. Thank you very much.